morning, and welcome to the March 24th edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy, on what looks to be an unseasonably warm day. Morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
We're going to begin our show this morning by playing an interview that we did several years ago with Justin Farrell. He's the author of Billionaire Wilderness, The Ultra Wealthy, and the Remaking of the American West. It's a book about Teton County in Jackson. Then we're going to speak with a current member of the town council in Jackson, Wyoming, Jonathan Schechter. And we'll talk about how things have changed since then and the unique challenges facing the Jackson and Teton County.
And then, of course, we'll finish the hour by speaking with the husband and wife team of Matt Tilling and Ann Vivian about their sweet new business, Max Finest Gelato Works, over there in Prospector. All this and more on Mountain Money. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. The United States exhibits wide disparities of wealth between rich and poor than any other major developed nation. Over the past three decades, America's most affluent families have added to their net worth, while income growth for middle and lower incomes slowed sharply. The richest 5% of Americans own two-thirds of the wealth in our country. Nowhere in America is this disparity more evident than in Teton County, Wyoming. There, the average income of the top 1% is a staggering $28.2 million. Some 90% of income is earned by 8% of households, and the top 1% make 142 times the income of the bottom 1%. And while Teton County may have been number one in average income among U.S. counties, Summit County, Utah is no slouch, coming in at number six in 2017 with the largest income disparity in Utah. Current average income for the top 1% in Summit County is some $4.8 million.
Drawn to the West by
old West traditions, the call of nature, and the longing for a more down-to-earth existence, the wealthy flocked to Teton County, Wyoming. Justin Farrell is the author of Billionaire Wilderness, The Ultra-Wealthy, and the Remaking of the American West. The book takes us inside the exclusive world of the ultra-wealthy. He discusses how today's richest people are using the natural environment to solve the existential dilemmas they face. But he also discusses the impact of wealth and wealth disparity on the community and its environment. Justin Farrell is an associate professor of School of Forestry and Environmental Studies, Management and Sociology at Yale, and joins us this morning to discuss the book. Professor Farrell, thanks for joining us, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Yeah, it's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
You know, over the years, there have been a number of studies and books that looked at wealth inequality, but you took an unusual perspective and actually sought to find the philanthropic motivations and intentions of the ultra-wealthy by actually talking to them. Why was it important to look at the topic this way, and why was Teton County the place to start?
Yeah, well, it started really with some personal experiences I had growing up. You know, I was born in Wyoming, and I've long been fascinated just with how the Rocky Mountain West in general is growing and changing. And so when I, you know, sought to do another research project, I kind of pulled from my own experiences in that manner. But looking at the scholarly research, you know, as you mentioned, we have a lot of work in academic research on, you know, these impersonal economic reports of, you know, the declining middle class or the concentration of wealth at the very top, which is all very important. But one thing that we really lacked was to kind of dig in via interviews and observations and to speak with those who are, you know, at the top of the socioeconomic pyramid. And for me, you know, it was really to move beyond some of the stereotypes that we had that I felt were somewhat sloppy, you know, of the rich and frankly unscientific. And so I really tried to kind of get in at the ground level to spend time with them and to come up with what I hope was, you know, a fair and a really accurate account of how they think about themselves and how they think about other people and then how they think about the natural environment as well.
That couldn't have been easy. The wealthy in Teton County is a tight-knit group. How did you gain access to these often private individuals, and how did you gain their trust?
Yeah, that was the most difficult part of the research, and it took many years. But really, I have this kind of odd dual identity. So, you know, I'm a professor at Yale University, which has this elite gravitas that the many ultra-wealthy are drawn to. You know, they might send their kids to school at universities like that, or at least they value that maybe more than some other folks. But I'm also a Wyoming native, and I have this for some of the ultra wealthy that I interviewed, and this comes out, you know, in the book. I have this kind of Western gravitas that, or this image of authenticity that I found they really long for, and they try to find, you know, in the rural West. And so it was this, again, this odd identity that is the Yale professor, but also this Westerner kind of. And so that's how I was able to get in with them. But in terms of building trust, you know, that took a lot of time as well. And I promised them anonymity. And so, you know, all the names in the books, and there are probably, I interviewed about 205 people. Those are all pseudonyms. And so, you know, I would change their name and protect their identities in all sorts of different ways. And so just really promising that I was not out to get them, you know, and I really was trying to be accurate and as impartial as I could. And, you know, many of them feel like they do have a target on their back. And so that was especially important. And then the last thing was, you know, the interviews would begin, you know, with conversations about why they loved the rural West, why they loved the Rocky Mountains, why they loved these wild places, hikes they went on with their family, and things like that, to just build rapport, you know, before getting into some of the more difficult conversations about, you know, inequality, or about, you know, whether they feel guilty about having that much money, or just all these other questions that I would ask them.
You know, a consistent theme in the book involves the efforts of the ultra-rich to minimize the visible manifestations of their wealth in terms of personal dress, and to assert that everyone here relates to each other on an equal basis regardless of wealth. I want to talk about the Yellowstone Club in your discussion of that in particular, but first, let's just share with the audience your observations on this particular issue and the issue of perceived friendships across class lines.
Yeah, that was a theme that when I set out on the project, I knew there was some literature on that, but it became one of the most important findings in the book. And at first I didn't really think it was that big a deal. You know, I would come home from doing interviews and I'd talk to my wife and say, you know, they keep talking about, you know, wearing jeans and dressing down and looking like everyone else, or they would talk about, you know, friends they had. And it took me a while and over, you know, hundreds of interviews to figure out kind of what was going on. And as I write, you know, in the book, it really became part of the way, and it was a solution for them to wrestle with, to respond to these social stigmas of being rich, and the extent to which they try to go to, you know, prove to themselves and to other people that money hadn't turned them into these, you know, out of touch monsters, or that money hadn't changed them. And so, you know, they would tell me a lot about, you know, how the clothes that they would wear, that they, you know, when they get out to the Rocky Mountains, they drive a different car, they drive a truck instead of, you know, a Tesla, or they drive a, you know, or instead of, you know, a BMW, and those sorts of cars are frowned upon in this area of the country. And so they had all these romantic ideas about rural people and poverty, and they imagined low-income Westerners, that they were, you know, in kinship with nature. They were free from the snares of wealth and power that you might see on the, you know, on Wall Street or on the East Coast. And just kind of thought that people who were out, you know, living in the mountains chose to live there. They're living this life of contentment, of authenticity and simplicity. And so that played into the types of quote-unquote friends that they thought that they had. And I also interviewed the low income and working poor population. So I was able to look at the other side and like ask them, you know, are you really friends with these people? They kind of say this. So, you know, I tell the story of one guy, for example, named John, who, I mean, he made tens of millions as an oil and gas CEO. But since moving, you know, to the West, he would talk about how passionate he'd become about becoming a quote normal person. And he wears Wranglers, he wears cowboy boots, and he'd tell me story after story of all these normal working class friends he had, and how he just, you know, would go grab beers with the people who worked the ski lift, and they were just as they considered him a ski lift operator too. And so I have a lot of stories like that in the book about these relationships and these quote unquote, you know, normal people that they befriended.
So when you look at that on the inverse, what were the ski lifties saying about the wealthy? Did they feel that they were good friends with them?
Yeah, well, some of the problem with the perception the ultra wealthy have was that, you know, rural Western poverty isn't so much the ski bum, you know, living the dream. It is, in the case of Teton County, it's an immigrant family from Mexico, you know, living crammed into a rundown hotel room or an apartment with another family, often working, you know, multiple jobs, usually in the services industry. So, you know, at a restaurant or perhaps caretaking for an ultra wealthy family, and they tend to not live in the community anymore because housing costs are so high. You know, and this is all around the West. This isn't just in Teton County, you know, and so it's the perception that was off. And so these folks were often surprised when I would ask them that. They're like, well, no, I mean, I work for them, or no, I was their fishing guide, you know, and they were nice and we got along, but this is part of my job. And so I think when those people stop to assess kind of those relationships or even the way the community is going, it looks anything but normal, you know? And so this perception that it is the ski bum or it is the person living, you know, in a camper van, you know, those exist, but not so much anymore. And those don't make up the majority of the working poor in the community.
Over the weekend, I reached out to a friend who lives in Teton County and asked him, mentioned that we were going to talk. And the immediate reaction I got was, he fails to understand just how philanthropic this community is. And I wanted to talk a little bit about what you labeled the charitable industrial complex. Let's talk about a little bit about philanthropy in general in Teton County and then focus on some specifics.
Yeah, so there is this perception in the community, especially among the wealthy, that is, you know, people would say it's one of the most philanthropic communities in the country. And that was talked about a lot. And there is a lot of money that flows in that county just because there's so much money there. And so, you know, I sought to examine that question because it kept coming up over and over again in the interviews, and just essentially how the wealthy are taking care of the working poor in the community, or they're taking care of nature in the community. And so I just looked at the numbers basically. And what I found was, you know, folks did give generously of their time and money to local causes. But I found that more often than not, it went to very specific causes that tended to serve the wealthy. And so they were able to, especially environmental causes, leveraging philanthropy for their own benefit. And so they mostly give to these non-controversial causes like relative to environment and arts. And so you look at the charitable assets in the community, and then organizations that, you know, are doing mostly non-controversial environmental work, the land trust there, or the arts center there, those organizations have seen an explosion of giving that has accompanied the wealth that's come to the community. And so there's, you know, those organizations have tens of millions of dollars in assets. And I have graphs in the book that just show how these organizations have grown. They're fairly non-controversial organizations. Yet I compare those to the social services groups who, you know, are under more stress and financial stress just with, you know, the housing crisis in this community. There's even some homelessness in the elementary and middle school, you know, this in the richest county, in the richest country in the world. And these groups who are trying to support the working poor, their balance sheets are mostly flat lines over the last few years and even the last decade or two. And it's a pretty stark contrast relative to just how wealthy some of these environmental and arts organizations have become. And so that's kind of what I look at there. And I compare, you know, even who sits on the boards of these organizations and the amount of social and human capital that these these, I would say trendy, but more these organizations that provide, you know, these social circles in which the ultra wealthy run when they're in these communities. And so it operates similar to, you know, some of the elite social circles you would see, you know, in New York City or something around the high arts and the different guilds that are there and the different ways that people socialize within those.
So Teton County, it's not new for them to be drawing the wealthy. John D. Rockefeller Jr. helped create Grand Teton National Park through secret land deals. And you reference the Rockefeller paradigm in the book. Can you go into more detail on that? And what is the impact of setting aside large tracts of land for preservation purposes?
Yeah, that was fascinating. So I have, you know, in this chapter, well, this one chapter I call the subgroup of ultra wealthy, the new Rockefellers, meaning, you know, I would do these interviews and I would ask them all sorts of questions about the environment, you know, how they conserve the environment, if they're interested in that or not, and the things that they do. And it kept coming up over and over again that conservation, especially folks who were not as familiar with day-to-day life in the West or the rural West, they viewed conservation and environmentalism as buying up, you know, large tracts of land, almost emulating the work of John D. Rockefeller when he did that and then donated them for Grand Teton National Park. And so, for example, I have a story in the book. This one gentleman who every year he rents a helicopter and flies around the interior West looking for large parcels of land to buy and conserve. And this is their sort of view of environmentalism rather than some of the maybe the thornier political issues like climate change. Those aren't quite as sexy as buying up, you know, land and preserving it. And so, you know, they would have these novel pet projects that I, as I write in the book, they kind of, you know, sidestep the thorny reality of conservation and collaborative conservation in the West and working land and for folks who live in and have lived in the West, understand that and understand kind of the complexity of all that and how it's not so straightforward. It's just, you know, purchasing land and locking it up. And, you know, folks who are doing that, you know, often it would be through a private easement. And so they're in some cases receiving a lucrative tax break to do this. And so it's conservation, you know, under the banner of altruism in some instances.
But it's not just the tax break that they get. When you look at, you know, how much land could be in Teton County, and the more that's preserved, the less of the land is available for additional uses such as affordable housing. And so in turn, it actually makes their properties that they own more expensive.
That's right. Yeah. And so I have a term, I call it compensation conservation in the book, and that kind of revealing all the different ways that conservation can be financially lucrative. And so, yeah, it could be through just, you know, locking away land, and that way land is more scarce and it's simple supply and demand. The value of your land goes up, you know, and that's definitely happening there and all across the West. And I think, you know, stepping back, for me, there's this veneer around environmentalism. There's a veneer that sort of covers over the community and environmental work. And I think, you know, I argue over and over again in the book that all of us tend to think of environmental conservation as this, you know, unquestioned good. And we don't think of the way that the environment, that caring for the environment actually benefits certain people, you know, either financially with a massive tax break or skyrocketing home values, but also just this elite experience of nature and, you know, carving out your own private access to what you see as the healing tonic of nature. And so there are all sorts of ways that these activities can benefit you. And the ultra wealthy in some of these places, you know, just have the money to participate in those activities. And then, you know, it also becomes a vehicle for social prestige in the community. You know, environmental work is very important. Conservation work is obviously very important across the West. And it's seen in some of these communities as the most prestigious thing to do. And so when you have the money to do those sorts of things, it also affords you, prestige in the community, and you're honored by that, essentially.
Did you ever have a discussion that directly addresses what I perceive to be some fundamental cognitive dissonance between this repeated dedication to us environmental causes on the one hand, and the plethora of large homes that are largely empty 50 weeks a year and that are accessed by private jets? Did you ever really get to take that on or hear how people resolve that sort of what seems to me apparent conflict?
Yeah, it was so obvious, and I would ask about it, every interview, and some would recognize that, and some would recognize, I'm doing environmental work. Yeah, I may have built a $12 million, mansion in a animal migration corridor. So some would understand that and sort of admit that. And I have a whole entire chapter called Guilt, and whether or not they feel guilty. And I would just ask them all sorts of questions about that. Most were not too concerned about that or did not recognize that. And I think that is because they were so overtaken with this romantic experience of the rural West, of the Rocky Mountain West, mixed with this idea that they've become normal and everyone out there is just basically, in love with nature, in love with rural Western life. And people would, often say, nobody gives a hoot about how much money people have. We're all just here in love with nature. We all just love to hike. We love to ski. And, I'm friends with people who are poor, but they don't resent me, and I respect them. And so those feelings of guilt or those feelings, where you may recognize those ironies or those hypocrisies, put it more strongly, those are kind of covered over again by this community veneer that we're all getting along and we're all out here just to enjoy what nature has to offer. And all of those, the resentment about social class, about who has this much money or who has that much money or who's living in a mansion that has a heated driveway and who's living in their van. We're all just getting along out here because that all falls away when you're on the trail or when you're looking at the mountain peaks. And so it was there, but it was sort of tamped down by all these other factors.
So I guess the ultimate question is, does wealth solve the problems wealth creates?
Yeah, well, I guess it depends who you talk to. But in the book, I say no, that's a myth that needs to be overcome. And despite, there are many very genuine and very generous, ultra-wealthy people I interviewed. And as much as they want to help, that's only a Band-Aid solution. And in times where an organization needs to rely on philanthropy, it may not come. And you see the organizations in the West that are best at getting money are environmental organizations and in Teton County arts organizations. And the other thing is that just relying on philanthropy, doesn't prevent the harm that's being caused by the influx of wealth, both on the environment and the community. And these problems are brought by affluent population growth. The other thing is that philanthropy tends to ignore what I call these buzzkill issues about, about the housing crisis, about maybe homelessness, about rural economies and the reality of rural economies. One family said to me, the wealthy people care more and get about saving the local moose than saving their low-income neighbors from homelessness. And so they give money to these causes that, are maybe well and good. And, I'm all about the moose, just like they are, but there are real issues in some of these rural Western communities that are overlooked. And part of, it goes back to that mythical ideal of living this normal life in beautiful nature.
We've been speaking with Justin Farrell. He's the author of Billionaire Wilderness, The Ultra Wealthy and Remaking of the American West. It's been a great conversation. It's a great read. And we appreciate you being here with KPCW's Mountain Money.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right, Mountain Money, we'll be right back.
As we heard, the previous interview was from May of 2020, using data from back in 2017. That's 8 years ago. I, for one, hope that things have changed for the better. We know that COVID brought many people to mountain ski towns who wanted to live out west. New technologies made it possible to live out west and still run your business or work your job in a different location, if you followed those particular working hours. Joining us this morning is Jackson, Wyoming, town council member and previous Park City leadership speaker, Jonathan Schechter. Good morning, Jonathan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, thank you. How about yourself?
Thank you very much. Doing quite well.
So glad to hear that.
Yes, indeed.
So, Jonathan, we just played an interview with Jonathan Schechter. And you know, the data was from a while ago. I know, are a current town council member. Before we get to what the data shows today, talk to us a little bit about, you know, why you chose to engage in leadership and what sort of the overall political perspective is in Jackson, given these sort of dramatic wealth disparities.
Two big questions. The first one, why did I get involved? Mm-hmm. I come from a family and an upbringing that emphasized public service. And I've come to believe that the biggest difference one can make is at a local level, and the stars aligned. About 20 years ago, I served on our local hospital board for 8 years, which is an elected position here in Wyoming. And then 6 years ago, I chose to run for town council. I was elected and was reelected again 2 years ago. So I'm 6 years into my town council term, and I thought it would be an interesting way to take some of the work that I do as a professional. I run a think tank looking at growth and change in communities such as Jackson Hole or Park City, where the culture and the character and the economy are closely tied to the natural world around them. And I thought being in office might be a nice way to take some of my professional work and apply it to this place that I dearly love and other places that are truly wonderful, like Park City. So that's why I ran. And as far as your second question, I managed to forget that. So if you could repeat it, I'd appreciate it.
Given the sort of dramatic wealth disparities, I'm curious as to how that sort of affects the political environment. Do you have sort of dramatic divisions surrounding, you know, local politics as a result of those wealth disparities? Or is that something that you have to manage?
Oh, I'll be flippant and say yes in the way you phrased your question. Wyoming is the most conservative, the most libertarian state in the union. In each of the last three presidential elections, we have given President Trump the highest percentage of vote of any state. And we've traditionally prided ourselves on, as I said, quite a libertarian, small government approach to governing. So within that context of Wyoming's 23 counties, we are this little dot of blue in a sea of blood red in terms of our political leanings. We've traditionally been much more liberal, progressive, whatever adjective you would like to put on it. In that way, we're not unlike Summit County mm-hmm. in terms of our leanings. The other thing to keep in mind as part of this discussion is that Wyoming has the most favorable tax and trust laws for wealth preservation of any state in the union. The throwaway line is that we are an onshore, offshore tax haven. And so we've had a lot of wealth come into Teton County in particular, not so much the rest of the state, but Teton County in particular. And that money tends to be a little bit more conservative in its politics. So as a rule of thumb, we are fairly progressive, but there's a clear conservative streak, a libertarian streak, and that's growing. And from what I understand about Summit County's politics, about Park City's politics, it's mm-hmm. similar. It's not dissimilar to what's going on in your neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm. Good. I'm glad you're very familiar with us. So your blog posts at cothrive.earth basically tell us that Teton County, Wyoming is the number one wealthiest county in the U.S., with Summit County, Utah, in second place. Can you break down what is meant by wealthiest county?
Sure. This is on a per capita basis.
Mm-hmm.
So the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis every year puts out a wealth of economic information about every county in America. There are somewhat over 3,100 counties in America. And so you can do a bunch of calculations and analyses comparing different counties to one another. And one of the things they list is total income, total personal income. So how much income do the residents of a particular county earn? And you do a simple math equation and you divide the total income by the total population, and boom, you get per capita income. They also divide that income into its constituent components, earnings, so wages and salaries, investments, dividends, interest, and rent is their term, and then pensions. And so you can make calculations about those as well. So for about 15 consecutive years now, and the most recent data that came out in the end of 2024 are for 2023.
Mm-hmm.
So the most current data we have available about per capita income is from 2023. And in 2023, Teton County, Wyoming led the nation for about the 15th straight year. And our total per capita income was roughly $475,000. To put that in comparison, the U.S. per capita income was about 70. So we were about seven times what the nation is. And number two with a bullet was Summit County, Utah. And Summit County was at about $260,000. But there's about a $211,000 difference between Summit at number two and Teton at number one.
Wow.
And just to put that in a little bit of perspective, there are only five counties in America that have at least $211,000 worth of per capita income. So the gap between Teton County, Wyoming and Summit County is huge. The other thing I would just throw in there is that Summit County was the second fastest growing per capita income county of any county in America from 2017 to 2023. I'll repeat that. Out of all the counties in America in terms of the amount of and percentage of growth in per capita income, Summit was number two in the 6 years sort of straddling COVID. And in 2013, you guys were ranked number 13 in the nation in per capita. In 2018, 5 years later, you were number four. And in 2023, the most current year, you're number two.
And, you know, going back to the interview that we just played, back then we were, I think, number six, I think he referenced. And since then, we've Summit County has moved up to number two. Let's play a little with numbers as people sort of think about the realities of some of the things we're talking about. So, for example, if we look at Teton County with, let's round it to $500,000. That means that means that for a family of four, right, the average income is $2 million. Have I got that right?
No. Oh, yes. Yes.
Okay. I mean, it's important. So, and again, with for here in Summit County, if we use $250,000, the average income for a family of four is $1 million. Right? Okay.
Yep.
And this sort of starts. And again, you went back to starting out by talking about the United States as a whole. The average was $70,000, so household income would be $280,000. As you think about those numbers, particularly the last one, you go start to scratch your head and go, well, wait a minute, that seems awful high. And are we sort of getting to the fundamental differences between averages and medians?
Oh, sure. And that's, you know, a fair comment. And it's, you know, anytime you put something out like this, you're going to be open to criticism, just like my good friend Justin was when he put out his book. The thing that I would point out about that, though, is, you know, median may more accurately, well, by definition, it would more accurately reflect the reality of the typical person in Summit County. But the reason that I think it's important to focus on the means is because that's where prices are set. The higher number, you know, people with more money are better able to outcompete people for the fundamentals of life, particularly housing. And so you've seen tremendous increases in your housing prices in Summit County. It's spilling over into Wasatch County in a big way. I did a talk to Leadership Park City a few years ago about the incredible growth in Wasatch County, and I know it's only accelerated. And that's because whether it's Wasatch County, Summit County, Teton County, Wyoming, COVID just poured gasoline on a fire that was already burning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that really wasn't meant to be a criticism. It was more what meant to be a comment so that people could understand what these numbers mean, right?
I fully get that, and I'm not pushing. I'm just saying that there's a place for median, absolutely, which is helping understand the basic realities facing any resident of a community. But the prices are driven at the margin, and the margin is better understood by the mean, if that makes sense.
And that sort of drives us to sort of the next comment question, which is, you know, here in Summit County, we face massive problems with affordable housing, with transportation. And my guess would be that this kind of income disparity probably means you're facing the same problems, if not more so, in Teton.
Well, what I would argue to you or suggest to you for your consideration, please, is this. What has happened, thanks to technology, you know, the reason I can sit here and zoom in with you from 500 miles away, what has happened over the last several years, over the last couple decades, is that the improvements in technology have really made geography and geographic barriers increasingly less relevant. Mm-hmm. And as that has occurred, what you've found is that the umbilical cord that connects where you live and where you work is getting increasingly stretched and frayed and cut. And so people are having this aha moment and saying, well, why should I live in place X where I don't really like it, where if I go to Park City, or if I go to Jackson Hole, or if I go to Martha's Vineyard or Pickett, I can do the same work, I can get the same amount of money, and I can live in a place where my heart sings. And so why not do that? So this is a process that I call virtual suburbanization, because the same thing that caused physical suburbanization in the post-World War II era is now happening, except it's happening virtually. And so what's happening, and so my point in all this is that any desirable place, not just in the United States, but in the world, is experiencing this same fundamental suite of problems, and you enumerated a few of them. They've got increasing affordable housing problems. They've got increasing transportation problems. They've got increasing problems with wealth disparity. And all of this is being driven by the same fundamental phenomenon, and it's happening to every desirable place, whether it's Sydney, Australia, or Summit County, Utah, the same fundamental problems being driven by the same fundamental problem or causes are washing over all these places.
Jonathan Schechter, we could probably go on for another 10 minutes, but we have to go. Thank you so much for spending time with us this morning.
Oh, gosh, that came and went.
It sure did. I feel like we could go on, like I said, another 10 minutes.
Now, do we have a fix for this? Real quick.
Oh.
We have seconds.
why don't we do that on the next edition of this show?
Great. Can we get you back, Jonathan? We really did enjoy this, and we're not done. So yeah. we're constrained. We'll arrange to have you back in a few weeks, so if that's okay with you.
Well, how very kind of you. I really appreciate that. No, it's a pleasure, and I guess most of all, thank you for doing your show, and thank you for caring.
All right.
Because that's the essence of the solution is the caring.
We'll be right back after this.
We all have our preferred way to end a great meal. For some, it's an after-dinner drink, maybe whiskey and a cigar. Others may prefer a nice stroll around the neighborhood. And then there are those who enjoy a cool, kind of sweet treat. That's where Mac's Finest Gelato Works enters the scene. We are joined by business partners and life partners, Ann Vivian and Mac Tilling. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, great. So, gelato. I mean, where did the idea to open a gelateria?
Gelateria, you got it.
Where did that originate?
Yeah, on a vacation in Italy, when I used to vacation, which these days seems like it's going to be a while before I get a break from the shop again, but I used to love to take cooking classes wherever I was. And I happened to be 18 years ago on a vacation in Italy, took a pasta cooking class, and then found out about a one-day gelato class. So took it, got on a train, took the class, got hooked, and then just in subsequent years over the last 18 years, subsequent trips, went back 2 weeks at a time, 3 weeks at a time, studied with different maestros, and eventually was convinced that I should open a shop in my quote-unquote retirement.
And what were you doing before? What have your career tracks been like?
Yeah, I grew up overseas and then went to school in the Bay Area. And as I was finishing my undergraduate, met a couple guys and helped them start a microbrewery restaurant, which became a group of microbrewery restaurants called Gordon Pierce. Then ended up doing tech. First, it was e-commerce for restaurants, a few different things, and eventually decided, you know, I'd love to get back into food. As you've probably talked to other guests, it's not an easy business. It's not, all glamour for sure. But it's incredibly rewarding. And when you get to, you know, end the day and know we did a good job, we didn't do a good job, we satisfied people, we got people happy, going full circle back into food was, I think, destined.
And what has your career track been like?
Oh, my career track. I'm a creative, so that means it's been everywhere. but most recently, marketing. But I've done a lot of editing. I've directed some nonprofits, been in higher education. So I am a writer, photographer, and now getting into pottery. So I get to do the creative side and make pictures and things like that for us.
So the name of the business is Mac's Finest Gelato Works. Yeah. Where did that whole name come? I mean, what's it? It almost sounds like it's like art is being served, you know, with a spoon.
Yeah, I mean, gelato ice cream making in general is actually incredibly scientific. Every recipe has to be very well balanced to get it right. The scoopability, the sweetness, etc. I resisted the name, quite honestly. I came up with probably 20 different names, and friends and everybody said, no, your name needs to be in it. And I thought that kind of feels a little arrogant, frankly. And at the end of the day, they won out. Anne won out. So we put Mac's Finest on it. It's, you know, now I have to live up to it.
So you mentioned numerous trips back to Italy. About how many years did it take you to really become a gelato chef?
Yeah, a gelatier.
Gelatier.
It was, you know, over the 18 years and kind of between different businesses, I'd go for longer stints of time. Any vacation time I had, I would go. I would call one of my maestros, Luciano, I want to come over and learn how to make alternative milk, non-dairy gelato. He said, oh, well, you need to meet with Gianluca. I'd go and spend a couple weeks. And then just started making it for family and friends. And when I was spending more and more time in Park City, starting about 13 years ago, and then over the last few years, really sort of adopted by friends at Library Field. We would do, you know, monthly potlucks. And they'd say, well, let's do one at the, you know, last Sunday of the month with Thai food. Mac, come up with four flavors that might go with Thai food. So, you know, just kind of doing that over time and honing. But I have to say, making it, you know, even on a really nice machine at home, I've got a machine that's almost the size of a Fiat 500 sitting on our counter at home, kind of looks like it. Doing that and then translating that into, you know, shop production is quite a different story. So that's been a matter over the last few months of fine-tuning the machines, the recipes all over again.
It sounds like the community put some challenges your way to make, you know, four different flavors that match with Thai food and it expanded.
Thai, Japanese, Vietnamese, Mexican, chili cook-off, Mediterranean, of course, which you'd think would be one of the easier ones for Italian gelato. But it was always fun and great ideas from them and support from all the folks there.
Right. And Roger, did you get any invites to these potlucks over at the...
Holy Not cow. So much. So what does the term gelato mean in terms of, like, how would I contrast that with, for lack of a better term, vanilla ice cream?
Yeah, good question. Gelato to the Italians just really means ice cream. And certainly one of the first questions we get from almost everybody coming through the door is, what's the difference between gelato and ice cream? And I, you know, really think of gelato as Italian ice cream.
Okay.
I had one of my first maestros there describe it as, there are some technical differences, and FDA, of course, has rules about what you can call ice cream and what you can't call ice cream. And ironically, the Italians, who love to put, you know, rules on everything about food, where it comes from, what you can call it, they have no rules on gelato. So gelato can be milk-based. Sorbet is a, you know, kind of gelato, typically, you know, water and fruit. And so there's some technical differences, but Luciano, you know, basically said, gelato is ice cream with romance.
Perfect. So let's nerd out for just a moment. Yeah. Could you walk us through the process, start to finish, you know, without going, you know, hours and hours?
Sure.
But yeah, what is it? What is it like?
Well, we do everything from scratch, which, you know, I may live to regret. We try to use, you know, just all the best ingredients we have, we can get a hold of. No artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no pre-made mixes, which, you know, that's not even just ice cream shops in the U.S., but because of labor and skills and whatnot, even gelateria in Italy have gone the way of, you know, kind of these pre-made flavored mixes. And they still, you know, they can taste great. They can feel great. They're certainly easier to do. But we start with organic whole milk with cream. Roger, another one of the differences is typically American ice cream, first ingredient's cream. Gelato, first ingredient's milk. Gelato tends to not use egg yolk anymore, you know, for decades now. A lot of American ice cream still use egg yolk as an emulsifier. In any case, organic whole milk, cream, we mix it all together. We put in our sugars. We do put in a little tara gum, which is a gum from a tree in originally from Peru, which helps just, you know, keep the smoothness and the ice crystals down. And then depending on what flavor we're doing, for example, our pistachio, which is probably one of our favorite flavors. We have pistachio paste, really finely ground pistachio with nothing else in it, shipped in directly from Bronte, Sicily. Sicily. And we do a high percentage of that. And we'll mix that in. We might have to balance the recipe again with a little sugar because the nut fats, everything has to be dialed, every recipe. The amount of sugar, the amount of fat, the amount of water, the amount of solids to get it so that it's, you know, consistent scoopability.
So wait, does that mean that during the process you're actually sort of checking to see where you are and adjusting the ingredients as you go?
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And once we get a flavor, a recipe nailed, it should stay pretty true. But then there's even the very finicky display case that if the temperature's a little warmer, if the humidity's a little up, if people are opening and closing the door, then, you know, kind of daily, like you would your espresso machine, you sort of have to tweak it a little bit, and make sure that everything is scoopable. And sometimes it can take weeks for a given flavor to say, this one needs a little bit more sugar, or I could put a little salt in this one to bring the flavor out and to help the scoopability.
And of course, we remain available for tasting.
Absolutely.
Need guinea pigs during the process.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So are you tasting or are you using scientific instruments to check that?
Both.
Both.
For example, if we're doing fruit can be, fresh fruit in particular, can be very finicky. One batch of bananas could be way sweeter and have a lot more sugar, in it than other bananas. Strawberries this summer didn't come in particularly sweet, and we had a very short season. So we have different devices that we can measure the amount of sugar that's actually in a batch.
Good. So if someone's vegetarian. Vegetarians don't eat cream, right?
Vegan.
Vegans don't. Okay,
yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
If someone's vegan, so if a group goes in, one vegan, they can't have anything, or is there something?
So we try to keep at least one vegan flavor. Right now, we're only doing 10 flavors. Ultimately, we'll be doing all 16 of our carapina, our tubs. And then we'll have at least two, three vegan recipes. The current vegan recipe is a coconut sorbet. You just have to take my word for it. If you didn't try it the other day, sorbets can be extremely creamy, not, you know, people think icy, more like a granita or something, particularly sorbets that have chocolate in them, which has, you know, a natural amount of fat, coconut, which has a natural amount of fat. So we'll always do a couple, and we'll be doing more and more with plant-based milks, oat milks and things like that as an alternative to regular milk. But those are tricky, and honestly, I don't want to serve something if we haven't got it.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, remind us where you are and what your hours are.
Yeah, we're at Bonanza, Park City Plaza. I think, you know, even the locals here, a lot of people don't know it's Park City Plaza, but it's where Stacked and Nosh and Sammy's Bistro and Chabasco.
It's right by San Francisco Design.
Exactly.
One of the sponsors of our show.
Absolutely, yes. Just two doors down from San Francisco Design. The whole community there, the neighborhood, has been super and very supportive. Right now, we're open just 5 days a week. We're closed Sundays and Mondays, and we're open 12 o'clock to 8 o'clock. We'll be extending the hours, and we'll be picking up one or two days, and eventually our goal is to have our espresso drinks, particularly our affogatos right now, which are already extremely popular. We want those to be, you know, kind of right there at the level of our gelato. So we'll be open earlier in the morning.
And is there indoor and or outdoor seating?
This time of year, not so much demand for the outdoor seating, but absolutely, like our friends there, we'll have bistro tables out front in the right weather. Gelato and espresso is the perfect thing, kind of midday. You were mentioning at the introduction that it's a dessert, but we like to think, you know, hey, come on and have it as an appetizer, then go have dinner next door, and then come back and have it for dessert.
Exactly. And you're the marketing person, so you had a soft opening.
Yes.
And a grand opening is coming soon?
Yes. So this weekend we'll be having our grand opening, and we'll have some extra things, some new flavors to share. So we want to invite the community to come and join us, try all the flavors. I always say, don't be polite. Please try every single flavor.
Oh, awesome. Well, we just spent a few minutes with Ann Vivian and Mac Tilling of Mac's Finest Gelato Works. Thank you very much for joining us. We wish you a great grand opening and look forward to seeing you soon.
Thanks so much.
Okay, we'll be right back.